Welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. We are coming to you from our top secret headquarters at Project Quantum Leap, but you can find us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And please do us a favor by hitting the subscribe button on iTunes.
Hello, everybody.
Hello. Welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. We're here this week to discuss a perfectly fine episode of Quantum Leap.
Quantum Leap. And as a favor to you, we are doing it with our clothes on.
Yes, it's true. We had discussed the possibility of, you know, streaming this live on YouTube. And
nobody wants to see that.
Disrobing, but no one needs that.
Nobody wants to see that.
I have a feeling, Dennis, that now in our days of parenthood and, you know, as we fast approach our 40s,
people don't see that.
The days of us being naked on stage or in front of a camera are probably behind us.
I don't know about that. And I will say this: you saw this because we're friends on Facebook. So I got this basically what was a spam text the other day, of a woman, like you just saw her from like the chin down, and she had her shirt pulled up, like showing her bra and her breasts were pushed together. And, basically it was like, hey, I'm in Arlington Heights, which is like a half hour outside of Chicago. Let's get together. So back at her, I pulled up my shirt in a similar way, showing off my hairy chest. And I actually got a few compliments from some folks. Because remember, dad bod is in.
That is true. That is very, very true. Well, you know, hey, anything can happen. Yeah. Anything can happen. And, as we mentioned in last week's episode, we've both done it before.
Yeah. We'll get to that at the end of the episode. Yeah. But we're not here to talk about you or me naked. We're here to talk about Scott Bakula naked.
I mean, we could just talk that. We could just talk about Scott in the nude.
We could just whittle our podcast and our Facebook page down to just posting pictures of Scott Bakula, and we would get so many more likes.
It's true. We probably, our fan base would at least double.
Absolutely. But we are talking about The Plays the Thing.
The Plays the Thing. Directed by Eric Lanouville. This is actually the only episode of Quantum Leap that he directed. Worth noting that he is a person of color, and, you know, we've actually talked about this recently. We've not really had, many directors, that have been black or a person of color, and, we've had a couple, but, I think it's worth noting and remarkable enough. Has done quite a few television programs as both an actor and director. In fact, he directed a run of Lost episodes in the last couple of seasons, including one that I thought a lot of people enjoyed, which chronicled the 48 days from the other half of the plane's perspective, because, you know, as we found out, spoiler alert, as the show went on, that the plane had broken into two. We assumed that only one group of survivors were left, but it turns out that actually there were two groups there.
Yes.
But a lot of credits. Beverly Bridges is our writer. This is the fifth episode that she would do of five. Other episodes would include Raped, Permanent Wave, Hunting Will Go, Great Spontini. Our air date is January the 8th, 1992. Our leap date is September 9th, 1969. Sam has leapt into Joe Thurlow, a struggling actor, and we are in New York City.
I think it's worth noting, the original air date was January 8th, 1992. Mm-hmm. The most previously aired episode was November 27th, 1991. So we had a month and a half hiatus.
Yeah.
There were no episodes over Christmas.
Which is not all that uncommon. Even today, you know, a lot of TV shows will have their, you know, their fall finale. And then start back up, in January or February. This was right in that mid-season
thing,
Yeah, Spot. Which is interesting, too, to pay attention to, I guess, what they were airing during sweeps. Obviously, January 8th would not be sweeps, but coming up, you know, in the next couple of episodes, we'll have their sweeps episode. So.
Oh, yeah, the next episode. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, should we dive in with the TV guide description?
Give it to us, sir.
Sam falls into a May-December romance as a struggling actor dating a woman twice his age, and he tries to save his career and find her a break as a singer.
Pretty straightforward there.
That's a very straightforward, pun-free. And other countries, it was known as, these are pretty tame. Boy. These are pretty tame, actually. An Odd Couple in Germany. In France, it was known as To Be or Not to Be. And in Italy, it was known as Mother and Son.
Yeah.
That's kind of weird.
Isn't it, though?
Because the son is a part. Yeah.
We know it's supposed to be about Neil and Jane, but it's still, I don't know. That is a little weird. Considering the age gap between who Sam has leapt into Jane, it could certainly be misinterpreted.
Yeah, a little bit weird. But yeah, so Sam leaps in, and we talked about it last week's episode. He is in probably the most in the cushiest landing that he has ever had. Short of leaping into Samantha Stormer and What Price Gloria in the bathtub.
Right,
maybe one of the cushiest leap ins. Red satin sheets.
Yeah.
Nice room. And but he is not alone.
No, he is not. It's interesting because a couple of things, you know, right off the top of the bat, we get, you know, this nice moment for Sam kind of. It's, you can just see, you know, look on his face and in the voiceover, it's like, oh, how nice is this? Mm-hmm. You know, here I am, all these other leaps. And he brings, you know, he even kind of name checks a couple of leaps, including like, I think Leap Home Part 2, because he mentions like, you know, the middle of Vietnam, yeah, like that. Mm-hmm. You know, so he's, you know, he's definitely comparing this to some of the harrowing leaps in that he's had, and now here he is in bed. But he gets a surprise twice, if you think about it, because first of all, Jane is there, mm-hmm. as he says, thank you. Mm-hmm. And so the moment kind of gets spoiled twofold, because there's a woman next to him, which obviously Sam, being Sam, is just sort of like, oh, you know.
Yep.
And then Neil walks in.
And then Neil and Liz walk in. My God, Mom, what would Dad say? And that, and that's a third thing, because we don't know yet.
Yeah.
We don't know yet that Jane's husband has passed away. So we kind of get a triple of not alone, older woman, son walks in. Oh, and is she married?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is this a an affair? You know what? Yeah. What's the situation? And it leaves us hanging until after we get back. And of course, then we do find out that, you know, he has been dead for a number of years. You know, I think just because we're introduced to them pretty much right off the bat, we might as well mention Jane is played by Penny Fuller.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a lengthy career. In fact, you could say that about a number of the actors in this episode. A lot of credits to her name, probably recognizable from All the President's Men. She played Sally Aiken, who's actually based on the real-life Marilyn Berger, who, you know, kind of had a bit of a minor role. She worked for the Washington Post in Watergate and covering the Canuck letter, which was a letter that basically had to do with the fact that there was a Republican, you know, agent, if you will, that was sending these letters to, you know, kind of rile up a Democratic candidate. And she got Ken Clawson on the record as saying that they had done this. And so it was, you know, it was just kind of another little piece of the puzzle there. She was also in an episode of Banachek, which I don't know, Dennis, if we have ever had the opportunity to discuss Banachek before.
We have not had the pleasure.
Do you know the show?
No, not at all.
All right. So Banachek was a sort of a mystery show. It was a vehicle for George Peppard, who is probably most well known now for the A-Team and before that Breakfast at Tiffany's. He played the male lead in Breakfast at Tiffany's, and then he would go on to play Hannibal in the A-Team. But between those two gigs, he did this sort of, you know, TV movie of the week kind of detective show in the same vein as like early season
sure,
of Columbo,
yeah.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he played an insurance claims guy who you know, moonlighted as a detective, and it was interesting because a lot of the mysteries revolved around the fact that he dealt in like high-end like insurance for art, and so he was a collector himself, collected old cars, collected, you know, I'd say
first world mysteries,
yeah, pretty much. Anyway, a fun show, great, you know, and he was always great in it. He smoked little cigarillos. Anyway, she was in an episode of that. She also did an episode of $6 Million Man and had a stint on Melrose Place and mm-hmm. Mad About You. But for me, the thing that she stood out for most is that she was in right around the same time, actually, as this episode, China Beach, and played the main character's mother.
Ah, okay.
In the final season. Because... big old spoilers for China Beach, but they did this amazing thing in the final season. I think I've actually talked about it before on the show, that they went back stateside. So
that's I vaguely remember that yeah. being a big deal at the time. Yeah.
And it was, you know, I think it was one thing for them to show these characters in Vietnam and how it affected them. It was an entirely different situation to show them having to come back home and get
sure.
adjusted to life back home. So anyway, she played the main character's mother. And then of course we get Daniel Roebuck as Neil, who I
yeah.
incorrectly identified.
I want to hang back just one second for Penny here. Mm-hmm. She was also in an episode of Nightmare Cafe, which I loved. Yeah. Only lasted 6 episodes. Depending on what you read, it was only supposed to last that amount of time. And Matt Dale, friend of the show, who we always constantly reading out of the book, he actually sent me like a link to where I could watch all of the episodes online, and I still haven't taken them up on that.
I remember that though.
But it was very, TV Guide described it as Quantum Leap meets Cheers meets the Twilight Zone. And that was such a perfect description, and I'm not even going to, just to avoid tangents going on anymore. But yeah, look it up sometime. Nightmare Cafe lasted 6 episodes at about the same time that that this episode aired.
Yeah. And again, she was very prolific and has had quite a lengthy career, obviously, going back to like the 70s, you know, all through up until the 2000s. Then we've got
Daniel Roebuck.
That's right. Whom I incorrectly identified. He was on Matlock. But I, for whatever reason in my brain, I mishmashed a couple of things and mentioned that he had played the younger Ben Matlock in a few episodes. That was completely incorrect.
You know what? I would guess he may have read for that part.
I mean, it's
entirely possible. He may have auditioned.
Right.
You don't know.
That's true. You never know. The actual actor that did play that, now his name is escaping me. I think it's Tim... I'll figure it out here in just a second.
Sure.
So I can correct myself. But obviously, Daniel Roebuck's done quite a bit of things. Dennis, why don't you take it away here for Mr. Roebuck?
I'm going to hear for sure. I remember him mostly as Arts on Lost.
Yep.
And he was also one of the U.S. Marshals in 1993's The Fugitive and the sequel, U.S. Marshals.
Yeah.
Which was better than I think the most people remember. Not a perfect movie, not as good as The Fugitive, but it was still a pretty good movie. And then a lot of other stuff. Like you know this guy, you have seen him in something.
Yeah, I mean, even recently, like he was in a couple episodes, I think, of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. You know, so he's always out there. A couple of other things that I took note of that he had done in addition, of course, to Lost, Matlock, Fugitive, U.S. Marshals. He also gets a Star Trek The Next Generation shout out, as he was in the Unification 2-parter, which of course had Spock, the
meme. Ah, yes,
Spock.
Yeah.
He's been around for ages, still working to this day, and again, still working quite, you know, I mean, quite a bit. He's got like seven or eight things, I want to say, that are kind of like in the can, if you will. So, I mean, definitely someone, like you said, that you have seen, no doubt.
Yeah, probably one that stuck out for me, I totally forgot she was in this episode, was Anna Gunn, who plays Liz. She was on Breaking Bad.
That's right, Emmy winner for Best Supporting Actress in a Drama and multi-time nominee for that role. She also played Seth Bullock's wife on Deadwood and will be reprising that role in the Deadwood movie.
Fantastic.
She did a show that I don't know if it's still on the air or not. Just recently, I think, was the lead in Grace Point. Two of my favorite, you know, legal shows that couldn't be more different in a lot of ways, in spite of having the same creative team and a similar cast for the last season, is The Practice and Boston Legal. And then I thought this was really cool. Quantum Leap is her first listed credit on IMDb, which would make sense because she was only 24 at the time this episode.
That's really cool. That's great. Yes. What I love, to go on a minor tangent with Breaking Bad, what I found about interesting about her character on there, I don't know if you were aware of this, were the death threats that she got.
Yeah.
Because people hated her character so much. And it was such a nice little microcosmic study in sexism and misogyny. Because she was always, have you ever seen the show? Basically, she always was antagonistic to whatever Walter's point of view was. And Walter was the anti-hero of the show. And so, yeah, a lot of men hated her, and the actor in real life got death threats.
Yeah.
That's kind of, yeah.
I being a fan of the show, it's difficult because you are supposed to, I think, early on be very invested in Walter, and when she does become such an antagonist for him, it's easy to dislike some of the things that she does. But I think that if you're really paying attention, she's one of the more sympathetic characters on the show.
She is. And what I hate about, because I started to realize that I didn't like her because she was always butting heads and she was contradicting herself. Like sometimes her point of view would flip.
Yeah.
Like in the course of three episodes, and I was starting to dislike her character, but then I realized that the writers were doing her a disservice.
Yeah.
That the you know, we talk about a lot on the show that sometimes Al is written inconsistently to be a counterpoint to Sam. And they were doing that with her character. It was like she would always flip her point of view just to be antagonistic to Walter.
Right.
And so that was a thing on the writers and not the character itself, herself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I would say that she was unfortunately written, you know, a bit inconsistent. Which I think is a testament to the actor in the show overall, that they, I think, did overcome that, especially by the end. The show in general just takes you on such a fascinating journey, and I think again that if you were to watch the show with more of an eye and an ear for her character, you would see, just a lot of really great arcs for the character done well. And I think that she was unfairly treated, as is evidenced by some of the other work that she's done, because she's clearly not a bad actor. It was very, very interesting. I think to this day, if you look back on all of that, like you said, there's a lot that can be said about misogyny and perception of work and blurring the line between actor and character, because it's like it's the same stuff with some of the Star Wars stuff that happened with the actress that played Rose and how she was basically forced off Instagram by the constant bullying and trolling, and it's just it makes no sense to me. And obviously, you and I, kind of having the background that we do, even for the people doing it, there is some difficulty every once in a while when you're in a project and making that separation. It's just natural with the work that you do. That said, it's like, give me a break.
Yeah.
Like, it's not the same thing. And especially in such a collaborative a profession, how can you possibly put all of the blame on one person?
Sure.
For that, and I mean, ultimately, shouldn't you just have better fucking things to do with your time?
Right. Anyway. Says the host. Says the new host of the Quantum Leap podcast. Fates Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast. Let's move on. Robert Pine. Here's what I will always remember Robert Pine from. Chips.
Yeah.
Which, when I was a kid, I thought it was a very serious show. I didn't realize how campy that show was, intentionally or unintentionally. But right. My mom loved watching Chips. It was like a permanent daytime rerun.
Well, the interesting thing about Robert Pine, in addition to Chips, is that he has played arguably a couple of beloved characters' fathers. He played Thomas Magnum's father.
I didn't know that. Okay.
And so obviously he'd worked with Don Belisario before. Yeah. The interesting thing is he played him in flashbacks. Because if I'm not mistaken, he was dead by the time that the Magnum P.I. actually came along.
So which is why Magnum was always so dark and yeah.
He played him in flashbacks in like three different episodes. He also played Jim Halpert's dad on The Office.
I could totally see that.
Yeah, and in real life, he plays, doesn't play, he is the father of Chris Pine. So,
okay.
Yeah, how about that? I had no idea. In addition to, of course, that being a Star Trek connection, he was also in an episode of Star Trek Voyager and reunited with Scott Bakula in an episode of Star Trek Enterprise.
All right.
Yeah, but man, yeah, I mean, he's another guy that honestly, like Daniel Roebuck, Penny Fuller obviously have a long list of credits. Man, if you go on and you look at Robert Pine's credit list, it goes back to like 1967 and goes all the way up to like 2000. Yeah, I mean, he's been around 40 plus years working consistently, and just the thing that fascinated me is as I was kind of scrolling through his IMDb is that he would have like 10 or 15 projects in one year, you know. And granted, a lot of that would be TV, but still, it's like he's working, you know. Those would be, and obviously Ted has not been introduced in this episode yet, but those are kind of our big guest stars.
And the director, Craig Richard Nelson, he looks, I don't know if it was intentional, but, if you're familiar with Spalding Gray, who was a performance artist and monologist, kind of looks a little bit like him. And I always wondered if that was an intentional thing, because I don't know very much about Spalding Gray, but I do know that he was quite eccentric.
Yeah. I know that as well. There's been a couple of, there's a play, written about him / by him or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he did a few one man shows. Excuse me. There's been a couple of films, including a movie called Grey's Anatomy. Completely different from the one that's been on the air for like 15 years. I could definitely see that. He was in the film The Paper Chase, which if you've never seen, it's a great, great film actually, worth checking out. Also did an episode of Star Trek Voyager. And another Star Trek connection is Petra was played by Ava Loseth, and she was in an episode of Deep Space Nine, as well as doing some Doogie Howser, Saved by the Bell, etc. Our mirror image is Will Schaub, and he was in an episode.
He has quite the extensive career, yeah.
Yeah, compared to a lot of other
movies. Much more than the typical mirror image, yeah.
He had a stint on The Young and the Restless most recently, it looks like. And was also in a couple episodes of JAG.
So there we go.
Don Belisario's team.
There we go. Everybody who has listened on IMDb, everyone is still alive but one. The King.
Wait, who...
Dean Bistro, the king inside the play. He passed away in 2005.
Well, son of a bitch.
We were so close. I was just like, as you were talking, I was like flipping through all the things. Like, oh, they're all going to be alive. No, they're not all alive. Mm. Anyway, let's get into the episode. I don't know where to jump in. I don't know if this is an episode where we need to go like a play by play or blow by blow. To me, it's more like what I really enjoyed about this episode. It's all more about the themes and individual moments, and it's just the fact that overall, and probably a lot of our listeners would be of the same mind, is that when I was younger and a kid, this episode had not much for me.
Sure.
Because, I mean, you know, it's about, you know, an older woman who's like trying to come to grips with herself. Like, does she basically give up and go home? Does she keep moving forward or whatever? And dating a younger, quote, younger guy who was like much older than me at the time. So it didn't have much for me. Coming to this as an almost 40-year-old man, this episode this time around had a lot more for me, and I enjoyed it a lot more than what I thought I was going to.
Yeah, you know, so I would agree with that. Honestly, the only thing that stuck out to me about the episode going into it is like, oh, right, this is the one where there's the, you know, the naked Hamlet. Upon rewatching it, it plays, and I don't mean this in a negative light, and I don't mean this to say that this is what it is, because there's definitely more to it than that, and it's not strictly this at all. But to me, it plays a bit like a romantic comedy. It gets, you know, I think it gets a little bit more serious than your run-of-the-mill rom-com, but it feels a little bit more along those lines, especially the early parts of the episode.
I don't know if I agree with that, because like because part of the rom-com is always the meet cute and the couple getting together, and they're already together.
I
could see it in that when the Petra, is that her name? Yeah, when Petra makes her move on Joe and Jane walks in on it, you know, like there is that stereotypical thing that you see in rom-coms. There's the thing that temporarily drives a wedge between the two characters.
I get
before
yeah,
they
I
mean, reunite, yeah.
And even the stuff with Neil, and I think, you know, Liz, her character in general, like, it's just there are aspects of the episode, you know, barring the meet cute, which, you know, is definitely, I think, is usually a part of a lot of rom-coms, but I don't think rom-coms always have to have that to be considered that. But anyway, point is it just felt that way with the you know, the more comedic tone of some of the performances. You know, I felt like Daniel Roebuck was definitely, you know, in a very comedic world for most of the
episode.
Oh,
sure, yeah.
You know, I think that you know, Liz, she fits in there as mm-hmm. well, especially with like a certain sense of naivete, which is really nice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ted, you know, kind of playing the heavy, you know, it kind of worked on that level for me. And again, I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. I'm not even saying it's a good thing. It's just a kind of, thing that I thought.
Yeah. Some things about, I don't know why, but I remember this episode. I remembered Sam for some reason being kind of skeeved out by the thought of being with an older woman. I don't know why I remembered that. So I was pleasantly surprised when he was like immediately into it.
Yes.
And like, and I was surprised by the fact that Al was so against their relationship because of the age difference. I don't know why. I felt like you could have written Al a totally different way in this episode of him being like all for it. Another case of like him being written in a way to be opposed to Sam. And I was pleasantly surprised when I found out that I'd misremembered, and like Sam was all about it. And he actually like made a speech that, you know, older men marry younger women all the time. It's a crummy double standard that you can't, that it can't go the other way. So that's one of the first things that I really enjoyed about this episode.
I completely agree. And one of the things that I came back to a number of times over the course of the episode is how wonderfully this episode reinforces that Sam is kind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even I think without being put in the situations that he's put in, and you know, the character in general is driven, and again, as we've read and heard about Scott Bakula himself, you know, it's no small wonder that Sam comes off as a kind, warm human being.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed that as well. The crummy double standard thing was something that I took note of, you know, and even kind of going beyond that is that his support of Jane and her dream, and kind of, you know, it's one of the things that I like about this is he pushes, but he doesn't push too hard. Mm-hmm. There's certainly episodes we've seen before where he really pushes people into doing things that they might not necessarily want to do. But this reminded me almost a little bit more of in Disco Inferno, You know, when he's supporting his little brother yeah. with the guitar, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. Like, it's a, he's being supportive and he's giving that good push, but he's not, I never got the feeling that it was like, Sam, dude, you know, chill out. Like, she's got to come to it on her own. You know, mm-hmm. it felt very, supportive, which was nice. The one question that I think is worth raising, just because it's obviously something we've talked a lot about before, he does go all in with the romantic relationship with Jane. You know, he's kissing her. He's, you know, there's a level of intimacy. I'm not saying that they've had sex over the course of this episode or anything like that, but there's certainly a level of intimacy on display here. So I'm just going to ask, how do you feel about that?
You know, that did cross my mind, but I guess that we have gilded that lily so much and talked about that plot point so much that I was just like, yeah, all right, we talked about it. And this is one of those cases where, and this is great that you brought it up because I didn't really think about it beyond what I just said. If Sam did the opposite thing, it would have totally killed the relationship. Because from Jane's point of view, it would have looked like, oh, my son and his wife are here. That has changed our dynamic. You don't see me as a romantic interest. You don't see me as a woman anymore. You see me as a mom, and now you've suddenly lost interest.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And it's funny because the question was sort of was raised in my head watching the episode. Like, you know, the third or fourth time he laid one on her. and as I thought about it, I couldn't help but think it's a perfect opportunity to kind of delve into the fact that Sam is playing parts. And, you know, again, as we know, when you're on stage, when you're playing a part, and, you know, there have been times when I've worked with people. And I think the conversation has changed a lot these days, and you probably, I'm confused about it in my own head, to be honest with you, but I think that if you have a level of trust and comfortability with someone when you're on stage with them, there are times for sort of spontaneous moments of intimacy that aren't necessarily planned, talked about, choreographed, etc. And, you know, there have been times when, you know, I've kissed someone on stage completely unprompted because it was just felt natural in the moment. And I think that in this case, you know, Sam kind of playing that role and really kind of being invested in the relationship and helping Jane, you know, even being at odds again with Al and Ziggy to the point of his mission, you know, saying that he's there for her, not there for
Joe's career. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is great as well. So I think that's kind of in my head, you know, where I went with it.
Yeah. I want to save this for the end of the episode, cause I want to like save the really far off tangents for the end of the episode, but remind me to come back to talk about spontaneously kissing people on stage in the middle of performance. Sure. Cause I want to unpack that from a theatrical actor standpoint, but anyway, yes. Like you said, like it did cross my mind, but not dive too deeply, but I'm really glad you brought it up because yeah, this is one of those cases where if Sam had not played the part, it would have looked really, really bad.
Well, and it's clear because Jane was already having so many doubts anyway. You know, even when it came to Joe, you know, the seeds had been planted, I think, even before her son got there, but then her son obviously was doing it as well. Because we learn early on in the episode that she lied to Joe about her age. She's been telling Joe that she's 40.
I forgot that part.
She's 50.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is also, I think it's worth noting, too, here, that Jane obviously had Neil when she was very, she was only like 20, 20 years old.
Perfectly normal, yeah.
So, yeah, there's all sorts of wonderful little nuanced things, I think, in the script in particular. So kudos to Beverly Bridges about who these characters are and where they're coming from, that give you kind of a really nice... Again, this episode does not play to the sort of like the high melodrama that Thou Shalt Not might, you know, when it comes to family dynamics, etc. But I still think that there are some really nice moments.
It's played much... It's played much more for comedy. Which I think was a nicer touch on it. Let's very briefly talk about. I didn't even think about this until we started recording. Let's touch on the fact, and this is a old trope that almost any show that takes place in New York is guilty of this. Jane's apartment is really, really nice. I don't know if they ever establish what Jane does by day, but her apartment is really, really nice for New York. Yeah. Like, she has a piano that she can lay on.
I got the sense that there is a possibility, because, you know, she's out there, you know, chasing her dream, if you will. But I got the sense that when her husband died, that she probably
maybe left a sizable.
Yeah. Okay. That said, I'm with you, man. That apartment seems pretty damn nice, regardless.
For that, yeah. So talk about there like some other nice moments. So we get introduced. It's a fun moment when Sam realizes that he's an actor and he's got to go put on a show. Which part of me is like, dude, you did Don Quixote. You're fine. You're going to be fine.
Yeah.
It's going to be okay. But it is a fun moment to see Sam struggle on stage. And like him and the little interplay with the director, as far as like the director coaching him on how to get through to be or not to be. Yeah.
It's almost like, for some reason, all I could think of as he was saying all this thing, which is great, you know, talking about those sort of sensory things that, sure, I think that, you know, are always important as an actor. You know, what time of day is it? What temperature is it? What does it smell like? You know, et cetera, all those sorts of things. That said, all I could think of as he was talking about smelling things was Friends, when Joey does the smell the fart acting.
Okay, not familiar with Friends, but okay.
Oh, man. There's this beautiful, beautiful moment where Joey basically passes on this bit of acting wisdom that he learned, where if he goes up on a line or he forgets a line, just act like you've smelled a bad fart.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that works. Anyway. So I'll try to say most of my theater tangents to the end, but this part, because like the director is walking Sam through like what Hamlet's motivation is. So when I was in college, we did Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, mm-hmm, which is a weird kind of, I don't know what you call it, like tangent, spinoff, sideways thing off of Hamlet. Yeah. It focuses on two minor characters from Hamlet. So anyway, when we were doing the show in college, the actor playing Rosencrantz, Brance Cornelius, what a fun name. He is still a working actor to this day. He does a lot of regional stuff for Friends on Facebook. I get to see a lot of his Facebook posts. But the director was having him cross stage at this one point on this one particular line, and he was just really struggling with it really hard. It's like in the middle of rehearsal. And the director's name was Dr. M, short for Dr. Melanoscus. He was like, Dr. M, I don't get it. Like, why I don't understand, like, why I'm crossing this line. Like, I don't mean to be a stereotypical actor, but what is my motivation? Mm-hmm. And Dr. Rim, who looked like every stereotype of a college professor that you can think of, you know, horseshoe gray hair, the distinguished gray beard, and the glasses, mm-hmm, he takes off his glasses and he goes, in the real world, Mr. Cornelius, your motivation will be a paycheck. Please make the cross.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, there you have it.
So we get to this end. So the end of the scene, and Al shows up, and it's one of this was a great moment where it somehow rode the line between drama and comedy when Sam guesses that Jane is going to die. Like, he says, she doesn't die, does she? And like, Al's like, no,
oh, yeah,
it's much worse. In 2 days, she goes home alone. Cleveland. I love that moment because it somehow rides that line between drama and comedy, which I don't think the series has nailed in recent episodes as well.
I would completely agree with that. Completely agree with that. But you're right. It is a nice moment, and it's a great playful moment for Al and Sam, which I feel like we haven't gotten a ton of lately. So
yeah,
I dug it. Yeah, it's interesting too, to, you know, because it's been, I mean, we're probably what, like close to 10 minutes into the episode before we get Al's appearance. Mm-hmm. You know, and Al does honestly come off as a bit of a minor character in this episode. He's not around a whole lot.
No, yeah.
He doesn't have a whole lot to do other than, you know, make a couple of
Well, he needed to break after Unchained because he was putting in some extra work.
Yeah. Yeah, and he could smell that skunk.
Yeah.
So anyway, after the rehearsal scene and kind of, you know, Al telling him that he's there to save Joe's career,
and not,
you know,
yeah,
Sam completely disagrees with that, which is really nice. And they're going to go to dinner. Jane and Sam are going to go to dinner with Liz and Neil. They bring Ted.
Oh, that is, I love that scene and how skeevy it is. And one, in Ted's appearance, and then when Sam and Jane go off to dance, which, by the way, I love, you know, you talk all the time about episodes that happen to Sam and Sam happening to the episodes. In the scene where he gets in the back and forth with Ted about the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Totally a scene where Sam is happening to this episode.
For sure. And I, you know, I wrote about that. I love that Sam obviously has his passionate point of view, you know, based on what we've seen before and what his background is. But he shows a little bit of restraint and grace compared to, like, Animal Frat, for instance.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, slams that guy up against the library books.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting scene, too, because I feel as though there is a part of this, and I could be wrong, but there is a part of this that is backed up and informed by the things that he has seen and done while leaping. And it makes me think, and the voiceover at the top of the episode when he's talking about what he's leapt into before, it makes me revisit that theory that Sam's memories don't fade between leaps.
Mm-hmm.
And that he does remember a lot of what he's done, where he's come from, which starts to ask a lot of questions about Donna. And if he knows, and if he's willfully, you know, being ignorant because he knows he's got
these
things to do.
Yeah.
You know.
That's a good point. But
knowing what we know too by the finale, it makes you wonder if by willing himself to not remember, that's enough for him to actually not remember.
To not, yeah.
You know, if he's in control of all this. But anyway.
That's a good point.
But I like the conversation that they have here, and it further gives us a reason to hate Ted.
Yeah. I love when Sam and Jane go off to dance, and then, like, when it's just Daniel Roebuck and Liz and Ted at the table, and Neil, Liz, and Ted at the table, and it's just like they just flat out say what the plan is. Like,
yeah,
they're just waiting for Joe to get rid of Jane, dump her, and then here's Ted going to swoop in and take her back to Cleveland.
Which, let's focus on something for a second. They got Ted to come from Cleveland to, like, to what? Like
sweep her back, yeah.
It's like an arranged marriage, but the marriage, instead of being arranged by the parents, is arranged by the kids.
Yeah, that's so. But then this next moment coming up in the scene is one that it's like a low key comic moment of the scene is when Ted goes to break in with Jane, Sam gracefully walks away, and Ted and Jane have this conversation while doing their best to do this weird dancing that they just do not understand.
Yeah.
And they're clearly, they're both being silly. They're both faking their way through it, having this conversation about this serious thing. Just a really great moment between two characters that aren't Sam and Al or some variation of Sam interacting with someone else.
I'm really glad you brought that up because it kind of goes off of what we were talking about last week with Unchained. This episode gives us a few scenes, and obviously this is just a very short, brief thing where Sam's technically is still kind of in the area, but we do get scenes that don't involve Sam.
Yeah.
You know, there are scenes between Neil and Liz, there are scenes between Neil, Liz, and Jane, there's stuff between Ted and Jane, you know, there's stuff that doesn't involve Sam, and that's not something that we do often get a whole lot of because... it's Sam's show.
Yeah, exactly. And then is it Sam? Does he, like, take the initiative? Does he push Jane into, like, singing? Because, he checks with the band. They know the song. And then Jane gets up and she chokes.
Yeah, and it, and the thing is, the thing kind of almost compounds the stakes here is the fact that, you know, Sam is trying to prove a point to Neil by doing this, you know, just, and kind of telling Neil, like, you know, look, your mom's really good at this, and you need to see that for yourself. And then, unfortunately, like you said, she does. She gets up there, and she can't do it. We also get the moment right before this happens with Petra, where she comes up to Sam and sees Sam at the bar / restaurant, whatever. She's like, oh, narrow jackets, they're so hot, or something along those lines.
Sure, yeah.
Like, Sam's pulling it off, don't get me wrong. Like, he looks good at it and all, but it's just so funny. And it's one of those little, you know, markers of, like, right, we're in 1969.
Yeah. Because
honestly, other than a couple of little things here or there, this episode could take place anytime.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, the costumes in this one scene that we were just talking about, Sam's costume specifically, it was just great. It was awesome.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And Jane's dress from earlier.
Oh, yeah.
Was fantastic as well. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jean-Pierre.
Oh, yes. Man. Yeah. Yeah. And then, we get into a further scene, like talking about the choking, and she's not sure of herself. And then we get into this later scene where, not Neil, but Ted is kind of harassing Sam, Joe, about his acting, and Sam, being somewhat bold, invites him to come see the show.
Yeah.
And
yeah, well, because Ted even says, when are you going to get a real job?
Yeah.
And it seems like I'm an actor. Man, the derision that comes from Ted and Neil. And, like, as someone who has luckily, I don't think, ever had anyone ask that question directly, you still feel it. You can still
feel it. I feel it. I've had people, like, talk around that question, but yeah, yes. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we should just get to it. Like, yeah. I was confused because, like, it seems like they haven't had opening night, but then they get to this performance and it seems like they've been performing for a while because the director makes a comment about this is going to be closing night. And I get the feeling they've been this is not opening night.
Yeah.
So, it's a weird kind of conflation of blah, blah, blah. Anyway, well, if you're not in the theater world, it doesn't matter.
Right, yeah, right. But the other thing, too, that's kind of, that just, you know, makes you, it actually rides the line nicely, I feel like, between comedy and drama here, is that you can tell that Neil and Ted, both for different reasons and in different ways, are really, like, excited about the fact that this is going to be a failure. Like,
yes.
They are both.
Oh, God, like, yeah.
And the way that Ted even remarks about the theater and the look of the theater itself, and, like,
oh, yeah,
be aware of the place, like, it kind of makes you laugh, but at the same time, it does make you wish that Sam would punch this guy in the mouth.
Oh, God, yeah. So, we are not Broadway. We are way off Broadway where they're doing the show in New York City. Yeah. So, the director comes in and he makes this whole emboldened speech about how this is going to be their closing night because there's a lot of competition, blah, blah, blah. Which is weird because, like, the house is packed.
Yeah, it is.
The house is packed. I mean, it's what they're saying, like, most people understand. Like, to me, it would have made more sense, like, if there were, like, 10 people in the audience.
Right, right,
or
right.
Or 5 people there. This is when I still live in Louisville. I've been to a performance of a show that was in a church basement. And only 5 of us showed up. And the show was so god-awful horrible, we wanted to leave at intermission. But we couldn't because we were the only 5 people there and we were one group. And if we left, there would literally be no one in the audience for intermission. And we felt too bad to do that.
Yeah.
So anyway, the director makes a statement. We must be bold. We must be innovative. We must be nude.
Yeah. Oh, God.
And everybody's on board except for Sam.
Oh, yeah.
And they strip Sam down.
The rest of the cast is, like, stoked.
They are. I mean, they're basically pleasuring themselves as they take their clothes off. Oh, man. Sam, of course, being Sam, is hesitant. And this is where we'll save a lot of this for, like, the end of the episode. We start talking about more in the theater. Like, this so would not fly anymore. Just the cast making the decision for everybody to be naked on stage and stripping someone down.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit. But
and the 60s, yeah, what's funny, Betsy hasn't seen this episode, but when I described this moment to Betsy, she was like, oh, God, that is so 80s. And I'm like, yeah, but the episode takes place in 1969. She's like, yeah, but this show was basically shot in the 80s. I'm like, oh god, that is such an 80s thing.
Oh yeah, well, you know, it's funny too because this is not the first time that Al has.
I was just reflecting on that. Yeah,
has seen Sam naked.
Yeah, and it's yeah,
he gets an eyeful.
Yeah. There's one moment like he's watching Sam from behind, and the thing is, it's like one, it makes sense because Al should not be squeamish. Like Al has seen war, he should not be squeamish about seeing his best friend naked. On the flip side, you also see moments where you could very easily see Sam or see Al being squeamish about that. But yeah, we get this wonderful moment of Sam as Hamlet dying at the end, naked.
Right, which is hilarious to me because we go from, you know, Al telling Sam that he's missing his cue, he's got to go out there. Sam goes out there, and then immediately we are Horatio.
We could have done a catching falling star-esque montage of just all these different moments.
I just was surprised that we didn't actually get the title of the episode spoken. You know, like I just was really kind of like at some point, you know, the thing where I catch the conscience of the king, like that's gotta come. And it's worth noting here that you know, Hamlet itself is, I mean, so much of that play has been used for episode titles, song titles, movies, you know, et cetera, has been quoted to death, all sorts of things, and you know, the play's the thing. I think the interesting parallel here as far as the episode title to the context in the play is that Hamlet is going to use the play in order to basically entrap his stepfather and prove that he is the one that murdered, well, not only his stepfather, but his uncle as well, but murdered his father in front of his mother as well, to kind of, you know, drive this whole thing home. And the play itself has, you know, been sort of Hamlet's journey from madness and doubt to confidence and sanity, if you will, by the end of the play. Some would argue, anyway. And so the nice parallel here, of course, is that Sam is, you know, using the play as a way to, you know, kind of prove to these people that the arts are a sustainable, viable way of life,
yes,
if you will.
Yeah. Well, it does prove.
And the reaction.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, and it does prove sustainable and viable for Joe, because him performing in the show gets the attention of a talent scout in the audience who is not interested in Joe's acting, but in Joe's body. And what's the name of the underwear?
God. I can't remember.
Yeah, let me take a look. Let me see if I can find it. I cannot remember the name of the underwear to save my life right now.
But it's while you're checking that out, I will just say that it was very funny to get the different reactions from Neil and Liz and Ted, and especially because it's clear that Liz enjoyed what she saw.
Yeah,
and you know, and Neil is clearly a little bothered by that. You know, Ted of course could care less, thinks that this is all a big joke. But in the dressing room, you know, Sam gets that offer for the underwear, which
I can't find the name of it now, but the underwear that is famous,
and he says, you know, he turns it down at first, and then, you know, basically says, look, I'll do this, but do you have a jingle? Do you need somebody to sing it? Because I know somebody could sing this.
Yeah,
and it's great because you know, he kind of bargains for Jane,
yeah,
to be the singer. Of course the hitch that gets thrown in all of this is Petra comes in. Sam accidentally drops his towel. Petra takes that to be some sort of advance
sign. Yeah,
she's more than welcome to herself. She drops her towel, embraces Joe/Sam, and of course at that very moment is when Jane and Neil and Liz and Ted and everybody walk in and they see what's happening and think that this is
a thing. Yeah.
Yeah. That this is a thing that, of course, you know, Joe was always going to do this to poor Jane. And Jane, of course, is very upset and they run off. And, you know, now Sam has to explain what happened.
Do the thing. Yeah. Nice little scene
I
between.
I want to mention real quick.
Go ahead.
that I, it was there's a poster in the background of the dressing room for Happy Birthday, Wanda June.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, the only play. I could be mistaken about that. But it's a play by Kurt Vonnegut. And I actually did a reading of that play at the Vonnegut Museum in Indianapolis.
Got it. Yeah, Matt notes in his book that that play did not debut until 1971.
There are lots of anachronisms in this
episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it happens. It happens. I love the scene between Sam and Al on the streets of New York, like Sam trying to catch a taxi, not being able to get one, like running across. That was a nice scene. That was a nice, it was a nice playful moment between the two characters.
Yeah.
And then, we get to where Sam tells Jane what was really going on and convinces her that, yeah, nothing was happening with Petra. I got you shot to go to Jingle. Let's do that. And he finally talks her into it over everybody else's objections. And then we get to...
Yeah, but Ted punches him in the face.
Oh, that's right. How do I forget that?
And Sam doesn't retaliate at all because Sam is kind.
Sam, I mean, come on. I mean, Neil got off one good punch because he took Sam by surprise.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I'm kind of surprised by that. Totally forgot that moment. But, like, it wouldn't have been a fair fight.
No, and it's funny, too, because Al is like, you know, he'd kick your head off, you nozzle, and,
yeah,
you know. Sam, of course, does not. And then we get to, like you're saying, and it looks like we're back at the bar, which is funny place for the audition to take place. But
an economy of storytelling. We've already got the set built. What are we going to go? What are we going to go to the studio a week from now? This talent scout has money to make. He's got things to do. Let's go to the club. Let's sing. And she does that thing that's kind of a trope where she starts off very slow and timid, and mm-hmm. it looks like she's going to choke again, but then she ends up knocking it out of the park. And then we get one of those great moments that Quantum Leap always does. Al reports how happily they end up. Not only do they end up staying together, they get married a week from now.
Yeah, and you know, the thing that I really loved about this, Dennis, is that in the wrap-up...
Excuse me.
A lot of times there's a focus on some sort of success. You know, oh, she goes on to help coach with the Special Olympics, or you know, whatever the case may be. And in this case... You know, Al is very honest. He's like, well, she never really, you know, she does a couple of commercials and, you know, she sings with a band every once in a while, that sort of thing, but she's happy.
Yeah.
And it's such a really nice moment, especially with an episode that does, I think, underneath it all, have a wonderful running theme about, you know, happiness in the arts and mm-hmm. success in the arts and what that means. And to wrap it up with the fact that it's like, look, these two people never become famous. You know, they're not going to make $1 million. They're not necessarily going to work on, you know, on Quantum Leap, but they're happy.
Yeah.
And they're happy together, and they get married, and they have this, you know, this healthy, wonderful relationship. And I really appreciated that as the wrap up from that.
I do appreciate that. It was just a moment. It was just the fact that they get married in a week. And I was like, but you know, like they do. Do we really get a moment in that last scene of Neil and Ted kind of eating crow? We do, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because Neil's very proud of her, actually.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, so. Yeah.
And I think Liz even has something where she kind of says, you know, she's really good or something like that. So everybody, you know, by the end of it, everybody's on board. I mean, Ted, Ted is like over it. He's like, I'm going back to Cleveland.
Yeah.
Ted belongs in Cleveland.
He
there's nothing wrong with Cleveland.
There's not. I know some perfectly lovely people who gave up and went to Cleveland. No, I kid. I kid. I kid. I kid. Dana Norris, I love you. You never listen to the show. You're not going to hear this. And then Sam leaps out.
Yeah, and he's standing on a track. At some sort of military school.
Yeah.
When he goes to get the baton passed to him, he doesn't know what's going on, falls flat on his face, and It is not good.
Yeah. Boy.
Oh, boy. Running for Honor
is yeah.
the episode that we'll talk about next week, and I think we're going to have hell of a lot to say about that episode.
We're going to have, yeah, we, yes, if not next week, maybe we should take some time and get the right guest host on the show, maybe. I don't know. Because that's, yeah, I want to take some time to unpack that one.
Yeah, yeah. I think that there's a lot to unpack in that episode. And the thing that will be interesting to me in talking about that episode is, in addition to the content of the episode, to a lot of the circumstances surrounding the airing of the episode and
yeah.
the advertisers, marketing of the episode, etc. Because I think it's a... it is an example of the moment and helping to define the moment of when that episode aired and where we were in a sort of socio-political, cultural, even economic place in society and how we were handling what subject matter was contained within the episode. So I'm looking forward to talking about that, and I agree. I think it gives us the opportunity to maybe have a couple of guests on to help us with that discussion.
Yeah.
So
let's talk about we teased our listeners such as it is. So tell me about a time you performed nude on stage. I have a couple stories. I'll keep them brief.
Yeah. So on stage, it was.
Oh, that's right.
It was just a quick back shot. Just my butt as I was pulling on a pair of pants. Because the scene, was basically the morning after. Actually, it was the night of, but it was later on. It was the moment after, of course.
Yeah.
And,
what was the show?
So, you know, I'm kind of getting out. It was written. It was like this this triptych that was written by a theater professor
okay.
of mine in college. So this was a while back, but the one that I think bears discussion even more is I shot a television what was hoped to be a television pilot ended up being a brief web series. In the first episode, my character appears nude, fully nude, full frontal, the whole nine yards.
Mm-hmm.
And that experience was a little nerve-wracking for a couple of reasons. The main one being that in the first scene, I was supposed to wear an apparatus, if you will, and said apparatus was not working. So I said the hell with it and just, you know, tossed the apparatus and just ran. And let's say I say apparatus is literally basically just a sock.
I got you. Okay.
You know, has heard any actors or anything, you know, talk about such things before. Yeah, it really is basically just a sock. But it wasn't working. And so, we tossed that and I was supposed to be running through, but cornfield surrounded by cornfields, like down an old country road. And we didn't, we had permission to do it, but we didn't have the roads blocked off. It was nerve-wracking because at any moment I had to be prepared for someone to say car. And then of course,
duck down.
I was just in the middle of nowhere running. I would have to kind of, yeah, duck out of sight as opposed to somebody being there to like hand me a towel or a robe
sure.
or something like that. So which actually did happen a couple times mid run. And so I had to kind of duck out of sight. The other thing is that at one point, an actor who I'd worked with before and since, and who's a good friend of mine, is now the artistic director at a theater in Indianapolis. There's a point where I was jogging, and he pulls up next to me in his pickup truck, and we're having this conversation, and it was that moment where it's like, well, all right, here we go, you know. And in the moment, you don't really think about it at all. It's just, you know, you've already kind of given yourself over to the fact that you're doing it. But looking back on it, it is a little, it's a weird thing to talk about. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I was in a 10-minute play festival when I still lived in Louisville, Kentucky. And this one scene that I was in, it was just a couple breaking up. That was it. Mm-hmm. It was intentionally ambiguously written. It was a couple breaking up. And you could, like, the playwright was very obviously influenced by Aaron Sorkin. It had that very kind of Aaron Sorkin-esque back and forth, whatever. Mm-hmm. So the director decided to make it a gay couple breaking up after sex and then stopping intermittently to have sex again.
All right.
The lights would go out, and then they'd come back up, you know, a couple minutes later, and then we're back to arguing. And so me and the other guy, we started off naked in bed. And for the most part, we were mostly covered, except that towards the end, I got up, and I gave, like, a full, like, one-minute monologue, completely naked, in a black box studio. Smaller than the one that was depicted in this episode of Quantum Leap. Yeah. It was at the very end of the night, so if people wanted to leave beforehand, they could. Some people did. They videotaped one performance, and the camera was supposed to have been shut off, and they kept it going. So somewhere out there, there exists a copy of this.
Yeah.
And it was, yes. And then the other one, are you familiar with Frankie and Johnny and the Claire de Lune?
Yes.
That play? I was in that play in 2010 here in Chicago. If you're unfamiliar, basically it's Frankie and Johnny. They are a cook and a waitress who work at a diner in New York City. The play starts off. They are at the very end of wrapping up a very enthusiastic lovemaking session in Frankie, who's a woman, in Frankie's New York apartment. And she just thinks it's going to be a one-night stand. She's like, all right, I'll see you tomorrow at work. This is great. This was fun. Maybe we'll get together again. Who knows? And Johnny, who is 45 and just kind of bitter and divorced and is over it, he decides, I'm tired of looking. You'll do. And he refuses to leave Frankie's apartment until she agrees to, like, be with him in a relationship. So the first part of the play, like, we started off in bed, I was completely naked. She was wearing, like, some flesh colored underwear. And so ended up all that was seen to me was just, like, I swung my legs over the side of the hideaway bed, pulled up the boxer shorts and pulled them up. And that was it. I wanted to be completely naked for the first 10 minutes. And I just wanted to be spread eagle on the bed. I wanted, because it was kind of a statement of just how comfortable Johnny was and how lacking in self-awareness and how lacking of awareness of what Frankie wanted him to do in that moment. If he just get up and leave, and just, like, him to just spread out naked on her hideaway bed. Like, yeah. To me, I thought that was a statement of who Johnny was, and the director would not allow it. But my favorite part, if you're familiar with Gold Star, if you've ever bought tickets off there.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they still do it or not, but they used to do a thing where if you were going to buy tickets for Gold Star, you could read other people's reviews of the show or whatever. And there was also a thing where you could leave tips for other people, like as far as parking. Like, where is there good parking in the neighborhood? Dining. Where is there a good place to eat around there? And then there was clothing, which is supposed to be a tip off to other people's, like, what should you wear to this show?
What should you wear?
Yeah. You know, is it casual? You know, should you dress up or whatever? But someone took it as an opportunity to review me in that section. And under clothing, she put, the man in that bed should have been wearing clothes and not naked. Yeah.
Everybody's a critic.
Everybody is.
Well, you know, going back real quick, I should, just because you set yours up so nicely, I should mention that the reason why I appeared nude in this thing is that my character, the web series was called Neon Cornfield, and it was about a man who, during the recession, was going to lose his farm, and he discovered through kind of some crazy circumstances that he could raise money to keep his farm by renting out his barn to an adult film director. And the adult film director had an idea and a vision to use local actors in his adult film.
That is amazing.
So he's looking And so he brings you know, the crew in, and this one like adult film star, and she ends up developing, you know, kind of a bit of a relationship with the farmer. And so the my character is the sort of diamond in the rough that they found, the local kid who had certain assets, and they decided they're going to make him a star. And my character got very, very into it and decided that he needed to be in really great shape, and that in addition to being in great shape, it was important that he not have tan lines. So the best way for him to achieve this was to run naked through the cornfields every morning to get into better shape and get a good tan.
That.
So that was, and the one of the things about this pilot, I'll tell you, is my character within the adult film was sort of was basically the porn version of Han Solo. Like, right down, I wore like this black vest, like with no shirt underneath of it, but I was basically dressed like Han Solo. I had a blaster, you know, like Han Solo. The only difference is my blaster. Yeah, I did. My blaster actually had a dildo attached to it.
And of course, so it did.
When I pulled the trigger, it caused the dildo to move.
Sure.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So that was why my character was
thing. Yeah.
Here's something that I think will dovetail into the next part of our conversation nicely.
Sure.
This is an example of kind of what I was talking about, where they needed a scene. The director / writer had realized that they had not had a scene between my character and the actual adult film star within the movie. So in other words, we had a scene together, but we didn't have a scene like in the actual adult film. So they wanted to shoot the two of us, you know, about ready to go into a sex scene. And so we were literally like kind of sitting in the hay together. And we had to kind of improv it. We didn't have a script. We didn't have, you know, any other direction other than that this was going to be the preamble to this, to the scene. And, you know, when you do that, you just wait for the director to yell cut. And so we start going, and, you know, and she starts taking my vest off, and, you know, I've got my hand on her neck or whatever, and all this sort of stuff. And you get to that point where, you know, it used to be said, and who knows if it's said anymore, but it used to be said that if you got so close to somebody on stage, you either, you know, it was a moment where you either had to hit them or kiss them.
Yeah. I haven't heard that in a while. Yeah.
We were so close to one another where it was like, and the director hadn't yet cut. So we started, you know, kissing.
Yeah.
Pretty vigorously. And then, you know, we start to lay back, and then finally he gets cut, and that's the end of the scene. Again, like I said, though, we'd had no rehearsal for that. We'd had no direction. We'd had no discussion. We just did it.
Yeah.
There have been a couple of times on stage where, I can think of two moments in particular. One was within a scene where my character and another character had kissed, were in a romantic relationship, were physically intimate with one another, and then just spontaneously we kind of like added another kiss in or whatever. And then I can think of a show that you directed me in actually, for sort of a play festival, where we had not, there'd been no discussion about it. There'd been no direction to do it, but it, you know, at one point we're sitting there and we're supposed to be, you know, with our newborn child. And so I just, you know, leaned over and gave the actor I was working with a quick little, you know, kind of peck just to kind of like sort of.
Sure.
Because there had been some tension as to whether or not this marriage would survive, if you will. This is way tangential from all the other stuff that we've kind of talked about having to do with the episode, but because it was something that was brought up earlier, I guess, it's a very different conversation now.
I mean, it's the, I would say, like, it really started with the Me Too movement. And I should say that In particularly in theater now, there is this movement now that whenever there is any kind of intimacy, that there is an intimacy designer who is a part of the production, and it's not just one time. It's like every rehearsal, every performance, everybody is checking in with everybody to make sure that everybody is absolutely comfortable with everything physical that is going on, and that that really kind of started in Chicago with the organization Not in Our House. Which came about to address one theater in Chicago, which is no longer very much because of Not in Our House, but because of like sexual abuses that happened during the course of that.
Yeah, I think just we can come right out and say it is Profiles and
the Profiles Theater. Yes.
And the reason why I think that it's worth actually mentioning the name of the theater company is because if you do live in Chicago, if you know anything about Chicago theater, if you're not just, you know, brand new to the scene, and even if you don't necessarily, you may actually be familiar with Profiles because the theater was quite critically acclaimed. You know, a lot of awards, you know, were given to that theater, a lot of great, you know, critical reviews. A very well-known playwright, you know, Neil LaBute had been... like
a lot of
residents, you know, had works premiere with them, and the artistic director slash, you know, leading man of the theater who had starred, if you will, in a lot of the shows there, had gotten a lot of critical acclaim specifically, and
sure.
It turned out that, you know, he was a dirtbag,
yeah,
and so the theater is no more. I feel as though there is a lot of nuance missing from the overall conversation. And I think it's part of it is because there's a lot of justifiable anger on one side of the conversation and a lot of justifiable and well-deserved fear on the other side of the conversation. But I do actually think that there is a middle ground worth exploring because I will always believe that the two people that know best what should be happening in those moments are the two actors that are actually in that moment. And that I say that with all due respect to any sort of intimacy choreographer or director mm-hmm. or designer or whatever the label we put on them. But I just know that I, as an actor, would much rather put my trust in my scene partner.
Sure.
And hope that they would put their trust in me.
I got
to be
you.
Safe and to craft something, then I would have to try to put it in anyone else's hands.
That's a great point, because the thing is, like, and I will say this, the last show that I was in was like a year and a half ago, and I had a lot of kissing and making out with my co-star, and the director kind of sat us down at the beginning of the process, and he basically like, I'm going to let you two figure it out. And it worked. You know, we had moments where, like, there were some performances, like, I would come in, I would throw in an extra kiss. Some performances, he would come in, he would throw in an extra kiss. And it worked. I do think, but it did worry me when the director first sat us down and gave us that note, because at that time, I didn't know my co-star very well. And I didn't know how he was going to be. And I've never worked on a show with an intimacy designer, and maybe I should talk with one to see what they do. But like I never dictating what the action is, and you know you kiss here, you don't kiss here, you touch here, you don't touch here. But like them being kind of like an advocate. So if you do get in a situation where your co-star is just being creepy, for lack of a better term, is that you have a person to go to and say, I'm not comfortable with this. Or even like as you're staging it, like you have someone to guide it. You say like, are you comfortable with this? Are you not comfortable with this? And I will say, because this conversation I was already got along, I've had situations in auditions where I was called on to do things I was not comfortable with. I was called on to kiss someone that I didn't know very well. I was called on to violently kiss someone because it was like the start of an assault or me coming on to a woman who didn't want it. Mm-hmm. And there are times like I wish there had been more awareness of that at the time. Because I have done things in auditions that I was not comfortable with, but I felt like I needed to do them because these were this was the script, the particular part of the script that was given to me. So I was like, oh, well, I mean, if you gave me the script where I'm supposed to be coming on to someone, I assume you physically want to see that, or else why would you give me that script?
Right.
It's a thing now, and I know, like, in auditions, this new movement, it puts a lot more mindfulness and restrictions on auditions as well. Because if I were to walk into an audition now and I saw that script in front of me, I would be very comfortable saying now, it's like, no, I'm sorry, I'm not comfortable with this. Whereas a few years ago, I didn't feel that. And to give like the extreme example, like a few years ago, I went into audition and it was a husband and wife arguing, and it escalates to the point of, forgive my language, I just wanted like to fully describe like how accurate this was, is the husband, he gets so angry and he's like, you whore, I'm going to rape you right now to show you who I am. And the script like actually goes through the start of that struggle. So like outside in the hall, like me and the actress that I was preparing with, like we actually choreographed something that we both felt good with, we both felt safe with. And then we went in and did it. And we clearly freaked the director out. She was clearly disturbed by what she saw. And my scene partner, the woman, she had to go, no, it's okay. We planned that. But even still, I did not get called back. And I've always wondered if I didn't call back because the director thought I had gone too far.
Sure.
Like I said.
Well, you know, the other side of it, too, is that sometimes, like, I think that it's a learning process, you know, that I can't say that we have any hard and fast answers, because there is absolutely a part of me that firmly believes that the opportunity to tell the truth and to tell a story as truthfully as possible, you know, in the medium, whether it be film, television, or on stage, that's the honor, that's the responsibility, that's the duty. I think
where you get into the slippery,
it's okay to make people uncomfortable sometimes.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I know. And to me, the slippery slope of that is, I don't know if you know, like, the last few years, what Profile Theater slogan was.
What?
Whatever the truth requires.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but see, the thing is, you know what, and here's the thing, and this is what I think it really does come down to, is like, common decency, common sense,
sure,
tells us that guy sticking his hand up a girl's dress without letting her know that was what was going to happen, and placing his hands in certain places where it should not be without consent, that is sexual assault.
Yeah.
That has absolutely nothing to fucking do with the play, regardless of whatever he thought he was doing within context of a play.
Sure.
It's like, that's the type of thing that you better damn well have permission for. But I'm sorry, that's the reason why I think that there's nuance to the conversation that's missing. I don't know that I should always have to fucking ask permission to kiss somebody if it's the honest thing to do within the context of a scene. And again, I think the nuance is that you have to have a level of trust.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that you could just do that in an audition, like you were saying. I agree with you. I think in the audition, there would have to be some sort of agreement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wouldn't necessarily just do it. But I think that in exploring things in rehearsal or something like that, I don't know. It feels like it kind of goes against the way that I like to work. It takes away a certain level of spontaneity. It enforces rules on things that I feel like we didn't necessarily need rules on until people started to abuse
sure.
the freedom and the sacred trust that should be happening in that context.
Sure. I don't know. Yeah. I don't think there's an easy answer to it.
Yeah.
Because, I've done auditions where I'm supposed to come in and I'm supposed to kiss the woman. And like before we go into actually do the scene, like we'd be rehearsing together, like out in the hall or something. And I would ask like, is it okay if I come in and kiss you at this point? Because that's what the script says.
Right.
And, you know, and she would say yes. But then after the fact, I'm like, was she really comfortable with it? Or was she like me and she too thought that she had to kiss or else it would risk her not getting cast in the role?
You know what, though? And that's where I have to say, that's a part of the job, man. Like, I'm sorry. Yeah. Like, that's the job. Mm-hmm. Like, if you don't... Like, here's the thing. If that's not okay with you, then fine. Don't audition for shows that require that, or don't audition for roles that require that. Like, that's on you, and that's your choice. But you have to have a realistic expectation, then, of what that brings. And it's going to limit you. Because people do want to see those types of roles. So I think that, again, there's a part of me that says that's the job. And there are absolutely boundaries. I completely agree with that. You know, I have a friend of mine who was in a show on the north side here, I think actually in Evanston, where they had to have a choreographer because they were choreographing like graphic sex scenes
sure.
on stage.
Yeah.
You know, and again, like, yes, I get that. I think that, you know, that requires a something more than just that level of trust that we're talking about. I understand that. But, you know, I agree that that pressure might not necessarily be fair. But at the same time, again, that's the job. That's what's in the script. That's what, you know what I mean? That's the story you're telling. And if you're not right for that story and you don't think that that you're uncomfortable with that aspect of the story, then maybe that story's not for you to tell.
Yeah. See, I'm of the mind of like, if you are going to have kissing in an audition and you really need to see it, have an intimacy designer there at the audition. Make that clear. Don't make your actors guess what they are supposed to do. If you want them to kiss because you need to see that for some reason, make it clear before they read.
You know, one could absolutely argue, and I would not argue against this, that perhaps, yeah, an audition piece, aside for an audition, is not the best place to include a kiss or any act of stage violence.
Yes, like that's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I can get behind that, but I do also think, though, if I'm the director, if I'm the casting director, that if I look at an actor and who I've brought in to lead for a role, and again, my side has no kissing or violence or anything like that, and they read for the role, but I know that the role requires that, and I ask them, are you comfortable doing these things? I would think that I don't necessarily need to have to ask that question if you're in the room auditioning for the role to begin with. You know what I mean? Like, if you're coming in and you're auditioning for Streetcar Named Desire, and you're auditioning for Stella, you better be all right with a certain level of physical
sure.
intimacy slash violence.
I would say yes, but on the other hand, I have heard of cases of where the actor gets in the show and all of a sudden they decide like, no, they're not comfortable with this and they're not comfortable with that. And then they're kind of putting up a bind like, do they adjust the show or do they replace the actor?
You replace the actor.
I mean, then you get into like,
I'm sorry, man. If it's in the script, like, seriously, if we're specifically talking about like Streetcar, for instance,
sure.
And the actor playing Blanche or Stella comes to me and says, "Oh, I'm not comfortable with this," or whatever. Then I'm sorry. Yeah. Then I'm afraid that we have to part ways.
Yeah.
Because we're telling this story.
I gotcha. This is.
I just there's a certain level, I think, of like, I try to be a very sensitive and compassionate person, but at the same time, I just have to say that, like, there are people that would do anything for the opportunity to play these roles or to be in these shows. Mm-hmm. And to have someone say that they're not comfortable with something after they've earned this, I don't have time for that.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah. I mean, I could think
That's not what we do.
Sure. Yeah. I gotcha. It's complicated.
It's one thing if the show doesn't have anything like that. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, it's one thing if we're talking about the miracle worker and all of a sudden somebody wants to, you know, add in a scene where Annie Sullivan, you know, takes off her clothes and runs around the well or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, if the actor comes up and says, no, that doesn't seem right that Annie Sullivan should be nude in this scene. I get that.
Sure.
I'm totally all for that. But if you're doing fucking O Calcutta and you come to me the first day of rehearsals and say, you know, I'm not really comfortable taking my clothes off, I'm going to be like, what the fuck did you audition for the show for then?
Sure. I gotcha. Anyway. This is a Quantum Leap podcast. Thank you for going off on our little theater diversion here. Anyway, it's like I said, like I said, it's been a year and a half since I'd done a show, and there was a lot of intimacy in that show. But the thing is, it's like if I had been creeped out by my co-star, if he had been creeped out by me, like I don't know how it would have worked when the director was like, "Figure it out on your own."
Yeah, I mean. I guess I've been very, 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 very lucky. Because I've never been in a situation where I didn't feel comfortable and trusting of the people that I was with and confident that they felt the same way about me.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I get, yeah, I have, yes. Yeah, I've been lucky. Like, I've been in shows where with people I've been creeped out with them on a personal level, but I didn't have to be intimate with them on stage either.
Well, okay, yes. Now that I have been in that situation as well.
Yeah, and it's like, well, I mean, you know, if I was making out with this person instead of this person, and yeah, I don't know. Anyway, it's a complicated. It's a complicated subject. Yes,
it is. But you know what's not complicated, Dennis?
Quantum
Leap. My feelings about this episode.
Yeah.
Because my feelings about this episode are, it's a perfectly fine episode of Quantum Leap.
It's a great. You know, this would be a nice. This will be an episode, like, if I wanted to, like, give someone just, like, a typical, not a special, not a mythology episode. Here's just a nice episode of Quantum Leap that kind of confronts ageism, but not in a beat you over the head with it kind of way. This is a good episode.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that I think that the episode is that we didn't really touch on very much is that it's a wonderful examination of kind of... kind of going off what you just said about ageism of, you know, you're never too old
mm-hmm.
to go after something if you want it, that you may lose someone or something or your home or whatever the case may be, but that there's, you know, there's always a chance out there for something more, you know, whether it be the relationship or the singing career, whatever the case. I think Jane as a character is a wonderful examination of that. But, you know, ultimately I do kind of feel like the stakes are sort of low, you know, mm-hmm. You know, nobody's going to lose their life. Somebody might go back to Cleveland. But, you know, yeah, it's not a bad episode at all. And it sounds like I'm damning it with faint praise there, but I'm really not. I mean, it is a good episode. It's perfectly fine. It is a, you know, but it's unremarkable.
Gotcha. On a scale of the Americanization of Machiko to the Leap Home Part 1. It's a solid, the play's the thing.
You just created your own scale there.
I did. Yeah.
I would give this a solid 3 of Al's cigars out of 5.
There we go. We just found our 3/4 of the way through the podcast. We figured our new measuring system. Three cigars out of five. I'm going to look for a cigar emoji.
Maybe
now.
The 3 1/4.
Maybe the three. There we go. Yeah. All right. Well, should we wrap this one up?
Oh, we probably should.
Yeah. Thank you, everyone. If you got this far,
go to sleep tonight and question all the things that I said.
No, hey. It's all good. If you've made it this far through the episode, thank you so much for going on our little theater tangent here. If you have thoughts, if you're of the theater world in Chicago or anywhere, and you have thoughts on that, feel free to share them.
Please do, and continue sharing your. We didn't get around to actually talking about. We did have a few comments here and there, about Quantum Leap in general. We wanted to kind of continue our 30th anniversary celebration, but we didn't really touch on it this episode. But next time around, we'll maybe throw a couple of things.
Yeah, there is one. I'll tell you this off mic, but somebody threw out a really good thing on another Quantum Leap group. And I want to save it for the next one because we're 1 hour and 35 minutes in case anyone has faded off. I want to save this for the beginning of the next episode because it's fan wank that I really, really liked.
Awesome.
And I want to highlight it next time.
If you're still listening, loyal listener, you have something to look forward to now.
Yeah.
Because it's good. We're going to put it at the top of the next episode.
Yeah.
In the meantime, let's leap out of here. Thank you all so very much. And we'll come at you next week with Running for Honor.
All right. See you next week.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed what you've heard or have any questions or comments, don't be shy. Reach out to us online at www.quantumleappod.com or Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And remember to hit the subscribe button and leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may be listening. Until next time. I travel in space and time. I want to stay there.